and from the New York area at 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. We welcome another news station to the Night Call Network, WTKY in Waterbury, Connecticut. Welcome. A recent Night Call guest, speaking about civil unrest, said, and we quote, "People rebel when they begin to see hope and progress," unquote. In the United States, there would appear to be enough hope and progress to stir more than a little civil unrest. In South Africa, there has been no rebellion. Every black South African must carry a police passbook, which indicates the only place he can work or go to school or live. A 259-page United Nations report states that South Africa's policy of apartheid or racial separation has created deliberate inequality in the educational system. In a country where blacks outnumber the whites 4-1, $39 million was spent educating whites in a recent year, and only $28 million spent on black education. A group of South African churchmen recently criticized Prime Minister Worcester, defending the right of clergymen to criticize the government's policy of apartheid. Mr. Worcester's answer, and we quote, "Cut it out immediately. The cloth you carry will not protect you," unquote. What is the future of the black people of South Africa? That is a question for our Night Call guest, Mr. Winton Nagin, who is standing by in Blacksburg, Virginia. Mr. Nagin is a black South African. He now teaches government and political science at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. Mr. Nagin, good evening, sir. Mr. Nagin?
Yes?
Good evening, sir.
I'm with you.
And thank you for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Mr. Nagin, what is it like, or what is it like to, for a black man to live under the apartheid policy of South Africa?
Well, firstly, I guess it's very, very difficult for an American to imagine, be he black or white, to imagine what precisely it is to live under the apartheid system. I might prefix my remarks about living under the apartheid system by giving you just a slight background to the bases upon which the system of apartheid is predicated. I have here before me a quotation by the brother of the present Prime Minister of South Africa, Mr. Forster. His brother, Mr. J.D. Forster, said in 1940, at a time when Hitler and the Nazi ideology was vogue not only in Central Europe, but also in South Africa, particularly amongst the Afrikaners. The report was taken from the Cape Times and reads as follows. The chairman introduced to the meeting the Reverend J.D. Forster, who said that he had just read Hitler's Mein Kampf. That book, he said, showed South Africa the way to greatness. Hitler had given the Germans a mission. He had given them a fanaticism which enabled them to triumph over all other peoples. Well, as we know, Hitler didn't triumph. But in South Africa, the fascist section of the population did. And Mr. Forster himself was imprisoned during the war for pro-Nazi activities. Needless to say, the system which he has predicated and which his party has predicated is a system based on a racist, fascist ideology. Now, what does this mean to a black man? It means, in essence, that he's a total slave to the system. It affects him in almost every conceivable sphere of his life. Almost every sphere of his life is completely and totally governed by administrative or legislative regulation. He is discriminated in the fields of education. He's discriminated against socially. Indeed, I might even add that he's discriminated in his social life, in his sexual life. I can go on particularizing instances, but I will leave it for you to ask further and particular questions in this regard.
Is it possible to compare the situation in South Africa with the situation of the black people here in America?
I do believe there are some vague parallels, but the situation is, in essence, really different. It differs in this respect, perhaps, that in South Africa, you have a minority oppressing a majority. In the United States, you have a converse. You have a majority effectively oppressing a minority. The other difference is basically that South Africa is perhaps the only country in the world whose official state ideology is based on discrimination, and the system itself actively legislates racial discrimination. In the United States, efforts are made, at least at the official level, be they effective or not, to attempt to equalize the difference between various racial groups. As a result, it's, I think, perhaps a little misleading to compare the system, the two systems. I think their motivations are entirely different. South Africa is moving more and more toward an enclosed, almost tribalized society, and it seems to me that the United States tends, on the surface at least, to be expanding the areas of civil liberties and so on. This is, of course, fairly dubious, and it's difficult to draw exact parallels.
Are there curfews for black people in South Africa?
Yes, indeed. In almost all urban centers, in fact, indeed, in all urban centers, blacks are not allowed to be out of their homes or their residence areas, which are called locations in South Africa, after 9 o'clock at night. In addition to that, blacks have their movements regulated by this invidious system called the pass system. What happens is simply this. Blacks are forced to carry a pass which contains certain particulars about them. Failure to carry the pass is a criminal offense. And the pass, in fact, determines whether a black has a right to remain in an urban area, whether he has a right to an education, whether he has a right to work in a certain area, and so on. The overall impact of this pass system has been, I suppose, really to prevent a permanent black urban working class from emerging. And, of course, the reasons are that if you did have a black urban class, working class emerging, you would have them organized more or less on a concerted political line.
Well, in every slave system, in every system that where there's any kind of dictatorship, there are always special privileges for those who comply. Are there any blacks enjoying any such privileges under the system?
To my knowledge, blacks don't really enjoy privileges under the system. There are certain blacks, you're right, who comply with the government's policies and so on, but they are by no means exempt from past laws and so on. They have perhaps additional rights in their own tribal areas, areas which have been designated by the government as areas of for future political, so-called political control by the South African government. But in essence, they have as little rights as any other black man when they move into an urban area and so on.
Well, within the constricted area where blacks are forced to live, are blacks permitted to supervise other blacks?
Yes, in fact, the system is based on a very old principle, and it's a principle of indirect rule. It's a principle used very effectively by the British in their colonization of the East, and to some extent in Africa as well. The system is simply to set up tribal authorities, traditional authorities, to entrench them by the physical violence that the state has at its disposal, and through these agents they are able to, in their view, control the ebb and flow, political activities, the social life, and so on, of Africans in the rural areas.
Are black South Africans permitted to leave the country permanently?
This is not an easy question to answer because the policy of the South African government has not been uniform. As a rule, black South Africans are not allowed to leave, or very few of them are allowed to leave the country with official traveling documents. However, black South Africans have been given exit permits. Here again, considerable delays have been experienced, particularly with students who obtained overseas scholarships and so on. And the service of the South African government in this regard in the issuance of exit permits has been pretty tardy. On the whole, I'd say the leaving of South Africa by a black is a very, very difficult and involved process.
This is Night Call in New York, and tonight our conversation, Apartheid in South Africa, a revolution waiting to happen. And our guest calling in tonight is a black South African, Mr. Winton Nagin, an American government and a political science instructor at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. Before I give out our special night call numbers, a reminder to our listeners that the sooner you call them with your questions or your comments, the better the chance you have to get on the air with them. And if you're calling from the East or the Midwest, you may call us at area code 212-749-3311. That's area code 212-749-3311. If you're calling from the West Coast, it's area code 212-749-3357. That's area code 212-749-3357. And if you're calling us locally from the New York area, our telephone number is 866-5010. That's 866-5010. We'll welcome our first Night Call listener tonight, Mr. Johnson from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who is hearing Night Call over WAMO-FM. Mr. Johnson? Good evening, sir.
Could you tell me what date Mr. Cleaver appeared on your program? Do you have that date handy?
The date, no, Mr. I
no,
don't.
Rich Cleaver.
I don't have it on hand right now, so if you'll call us at 12:30, we'll be more than happy to give it to you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, sir. This is Night Call in New York. Our conversation tonight, Apartheid in South Africa, a revolution waiting to happen. And once again, our guest calling in from Virginia Polytechnic Institute, a political science instructor at that school, Mr. Winton Nagin. While we're waiting our calls, Mr. Nagin, let's continue with just a few more explorations. What is the educational level of the majority of black South Africans?
Well, the South African government officially claims that it has the highest literacy rate in the African continent. Well, I don't doubt this may be true. I'm not certain of it because I haven't seen the figures for every other African country. However, when it comes to the field of secondary, high school, and higher education, the extent of education discrimination becomes quite intense. Now, the basic aims of apartheid in education were well summarized by Dr. Verwoerd himself. The basic philosophy of it was described in this policy called Bantu education. And the Bantu education system basically was simply this, that you wouldn't teach an African child, a black child, mathematics when the social status that he could aspire to would be that of a garden boy. Therefore, you would introduce into the educational system possibilities for his development in the manual rather than in the intellectual or theoretical aspects of education. In other words, you would develop his practical capabilities, his work, his usefulness as a farm laborer, as a garden boy, as an appendage to the white power structure. Alternatively, you would diminish the extent to which he could aspire to education in languages and mathematics and the sciences. This has, of course, meant that increasingly less and less, proportionally speaking, less and less non-whites have been able to aspire to higher education. This policy, of course, was exacerbated by the separation, the apartheid in the universities laws, the extension of University Education Act, rather ironically named, which in effect prohibited all non-whites from attending the so-called open universities in South Africa. In its place, the government set up a number of tribal colleges, schools for indoctrination, professors appointed directly by the government. And in the case of the University College of Fort Hare, which was once a free institution, the government politely sacked half the liberal staff members, and at the present time, I understand the institution is closed down. They simply expelled some 300 students in September, as reported in the Evening Post, a South African newspaper. And all in all, I'd summarize by saying that the educational opportunities for non-white South Africans are exceedingly grim.
This is Night Call in New York, Apartheid in South Africa. Our conversation tonight with Mr. Winton Nagin will return to our guest following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest black South African Winton Nagin after station identification. Night Call welcomes your comments about this nationwide listener call-in program. Your opinions and reactions are of value to the producers of Night Call in their continuing attempt to initiate and stimulate dialogue between the black man in the street and his white counterpart. Please address your comments to Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. The producers of Night Call attempt to balance the points of view presented on this series about controversial issues. In keeping with this traditional concern for free expression on controversial matters, Night Call invites requests for equal time from responsible representatives on opposing points of view if it's thought they have not been adequately represented on the air. Such requests should be addressed to Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York, zip 10970. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest black South African Wynton Nagin about apartheid and the revolution waiting to happen. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our conversation tonight, Apartheid in South Africa, a revolution waiting to happen, with our guest calling in from Virginia Polytechnic Institute, Mr. Wynton Nagin. We'll take another call, this time locally from New York. Mr. Johnson is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Mr. Johnson?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Your question.
I'd like to ask Mr. Nagin whether...
Could you speak a little louder, please?
Yes. I'd like to ask you whether the United States supports South Africa in any form.
Is that all? Well, officially the United States does not support South Africa's policies of apartheid. Indeed, it would result in an outcry if it did. However, a debatable question arises as to whether United States investments in South Africa don't reinforce and entrench the system of apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
My own personal view is that it does, and that I don't see any long-term benefits in the United States continuously reinforcing the economic structure of Southern Africa. But that's my own personal view, and I think a lot of people agree with me.
Yeah, well, isn't there any,
But you're talking about a positive thing, that you're discussing what the United States is doing.
Right, you know, I imagine they are involved somewhere or another. You know, I'd just like to know definitely, you know, but they don't support the policies, I know that, but they must have investments there, I'm sure.
Yes, and that's what I was speaking about. United States investments in South Africa are considerable, and the point has been debated as to whether these investments in the long term will result in an economic growth that will, of necessity, create a greater equality for all South Africans. My own view is that this is a fallacy, and the greater the economic investment of Americans is in South Africa, the more entrenched the system of apartheid becomes. And I might add also that the United States used to provide military aid for South Africa. That doesn't happen anymore, hopefully.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Apartheid in South Africa, our discussion tonight and our conversation with Mr. Wynton Nagin. We'll take our next call, this time from New Mexico. Mr. McQuaid is here, Night Call over KGAK. Mr. McQuaid?
Yes, good evening, sir.
Good evening, sir. Your question?
Yes, I have two questions for your guest. One, while attending New Mexico State University, I had the opportunity to room with a South African boy from Ethiopia. Now,
I beg your pardon? South African from Ethiopia?
Yes. Now, my question is this. In various conversations I had with him, he has told me that the standard of education was extremely low for the black man in Africa, and so much better in the United States. Could you give a slight comparison of that? And the second question that I have is, various times he has... him as well as some of the others have been almost in contempt of American foreign aid and with high praise for the Peace Corps. And his contention was that the American people should knock off the foreign aid and send more Peace Corps volunteers to work in South Africa. And I wonder what would be your general impression upon this.
Well, let's first get our geography straight. Ethiopia happens to be in north of Africa, or relatively so, and very, very far from South Africa, many thousands of miles. Now, secondly, it's very difficult to compare the whole continent's educational system in relation to the United States. I do believe that in some African countries, great efforts are being made to improve the standard of education. However, South Africa is different because South Africa is the only industrialized or fully industrialized African country at the present time and does have the resources to provide for its population, i.e., that is to say, all sections of its population, a standard of education equivalent to the best that can be offered in any other industrialized country. By legislation and by sheer maliciousness on the part of the prevailing authorities, this has not been the case. Indeed, the very reverse has been the case in South Africa, that is to say, the Republic of South Africa. At one stage in time, a large number of Africans, right up as far as Uganda, received their education in South Africa. Indeed, I believe the ambassador to the United Nations from Uganda is an ex-Fort Hare graduate. Fort Hare is a university college in South Africa, which catered mainly for the needs of non-white students. On the question of foreign aid, again, I'm no expert on foreign aid, but I can tell you that South Africa itself does not receive foreign aid from the United States. Indeed, I might add that it is the only country I understand to have fully paid its war debts to the United States. Does that answer your question, sir?
Mr. McQuaid?
Yes.
Does that answer your question, sir?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, sir. This is NightCall in New York, apartheid in South Africa. Our conversation tonight with Mr. Winston Nagin, and this time out to Springfield, Massachusetts, Mr. Fine is hearing NightCall over WFIC-FM. Mr. Fine? Mr. Fine?
Yes, good evening, sir.
Good evening, sir. Your question?
Yes, my question concerns the Olympics and their banning of South Africa as a moral issue. Do you feel that the what many consider genocide in Vietnam would be morally less justifiable than what is happening in South Africa right now?
I don't quite understand your question, sir.
Well, in terms of a moral question, do you feel that the genocide, which what many consider the United States is doing in Vietnam, is less justifiable morally and therefore more reprehensible in highness, let's say, than what is happening in South Africa with the apartheid?
I'll attempt to answer that question as best I can. Firstly, the problem is, of course, that the question of genocide today is one regulated by treaty, first of all, and determinable by a court of law. Now, to my knowledge, no court of law has determined whether the United States' action in Vietnam does in effect amount to genocide or not, so it's very difficult for me to answer that question. It is a legal question. The question of whether the United States' war policies in Vietnam can be equated to apartheid in South Africa is a very difficult question because one doesn't know how to make the equivalences. I think if one disagrees with war, then, and one disagrees with racial discrimination and sees them both as unjust issues, then one can condemn them. The extent to which these can be related to the Olympic Games is again a very complex question. I'm not certain that I can give you a straight answer, but I would say that if, and this would be an hypothesis, if a legally determinable objective court of law found that, in effect, the United States policy in Vietnam did amount to genocide,
yeah,
then it seems to me appropriate action in, on all fronts may well be conceivable and useful in, as a moral protest, but I'm not that certain. It's a very difficult question to answer, I think.
Well, did you think South Africa should have been banned from the Olympics?
Most emphatically so, yes. I'm familiar with that problem, and I've lived under it, and this wasn't only predicated on South Africa's apartheid policies. The point is that apartheid doesn't affect just political issues. It affects sport as well. And indirectly, the South African government has enforced racial discrimination in sport. It has refused passports for South African non-white athletes in table tennis to participate in the World Championships. It has refused to allow Basil de Oliveira, a South African colored cricketer who could not represent his colored country because of his color, entry to South Africa as a member of the English national cricket team. He became an English national. The South African government has in effect openly discriminated against, entered into the realm of sport and entrenched the segregation and the discrimination in sport. It has in effect actively entered this arena of social activity.
Getting back to Vietnam, then if you feel it is debatable whether we are committing genocide...
I didn't say it was debatable. I mean, it's a legal question according to international law. According to international law, it is a legal question. There's a genocide convention which in effect regulates this.
Do you think that there should have been a determination made and therefore a decision made on whether the United States should have been able to participate?
Well, I'm no expert on the United States policies. I'm sorry, I can't answer that question.
Right.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye.
This is Night Call in New York. We return to our guest, Mr. Winton Nagin, and our conversation tonight, apartheid in South Africa, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest, black South African Winton Nagin, after station identification. Next week on Night Call. Is war absurd? Does Czechoslovakia have a future? The Biafran mess, alcoholism, and Catholics and birth control. Monday, novelist-playwright Joel Heller, author of Catch-22 and We Bombed in New Haven. Tuesday, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Harrison Salisbury, assistant managing editor of the New York Times, expert on the East-West confrontation. Wednesday, Miss Onima Megwa of the Republic of Biafra. Thursday, former alcoholic Frank Murphy. And Friday, Robert Hoyt, editor of the National Catholic Reporter on Catholics and Birth Control. All this next week on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest black South African Winton Nagin about apartheid and a revolution waiting to happen. Call Night Call collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And a welcome to the Night Call stations who join us for the second half hour each evening. Tonight, our conversation, apartheid in South Africa, a revolution waiting to happen. And our guest, a black South African, Mr. Winton Nagin, an American government and political science instructor at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. We'll begin this half hour by going first to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Professor Hallgarten is hearing Night Call over KGGM. Professor Hallgarten?
Yes, I have two questions. My first question is, what are the chances of an uprising in South Africa? And which countries or which former colonies would be considered helpful? That was question one. And question two, can you tell us something about the situation in a former German colony, Southwest Africa, which is now under an old, obsolete mandate of the League of Nations and now the United Nations, which is no longer recognized by the United Nations as something really existing?
All right. Well, firstly, it's very difficult at the present time to determine what the chances of uprising are inside South Africa. I think it's generally conceded amongst people who consider that armed struggle is the only way to eventual liberation of black South Africans.
What kind of struggle?
I beg your pardon?
What did you just say? I didn't get the last word.
I said it is generally conceded amongst those who take the view that armed struggle is the only way to effect a liberation of black South Africans.
Oh, yes.
That a number of contingent situations have to materialize. And the first such situation is, I think, the two Portuguese colonies, Angola and Mozambique, strategically situated on either side of South Africa.
Yes.
At the present time, it's my understanding that guerrilla warfare is going on to varying degrees in both these colonies.
Yes.
I'm not certain as to the precise extent, but I understand that in the Mozambique, there have been a number of schools and whatnot being set up in areas allegedly controlled by Dr. Mandlan's revolutionary forces.
Yes.
The other thing is that Rhodesia is another pivotal point, I think, that would have to fall in a consideration of an eventual uprising in South Africa.
Yes.
I think before people are really going to consider effectuating an uprising inside South Africa, I think these strategic situations will probably gain a priority in those that think in terms of revolution. As to which former colonies will be helpful, I'm not at all certain the extent to which Bechuanaland, Swaziland, and Botswana, Basutoland, will be that helpful simply because of their geographic contiguity to South Africa and their reliance, economic and otherwise, on the South African regime at the present time. It seems to me, however, that the foreign policies of a number of other African former countries, and this would include, I believe, Tanzania, even Kenya, Zambia, and other countries, would be very partial and would, I believe, do all in their power to help whatever may eventually take place inside South Africa. As to the Southwest Africa question, position, as I understand it, is as follows. The United Nations terminated the mandate and set up a council which was to devise ways and means of assuming control over Southwest Africa. On the other hand, the South African government has gone on blissfully unaware or pretentiously unaware that the United Nations has in effect taken this resolution and has extended its regime, particularly the odious aspects of its regime, to Southwest Africa. A recent example of the extension of her regime to South Africa, her jurisdiction in this regard, was the prosecution of a number of Southwest Africans under a so-called act called the Terrorism Act, an act which was made retroactive for 5 years, which prosecuted Southwest Africans 1,000 miles from their homeland under what a law professor in the United States described one of the most savage pieces of legislation ever put on the statute books of a country.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
This is Night Call in New York. Apartheid in South Africa, a revolution waiting to happen, is our conversation tonight with Mr. Wenton Nagin, an American government and political science instructor at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. This time out to Bloomington, Indiana, Mr. Lundy is hearing Night Call over WFIU-FM. Mr. Lundy?
Yes, good evening.
Good evening, sir.
I'd like to ask Mr. Nagin, and you sort of touched on what I want to ask in the question preceding this, but I'd like for you to sort of clarify, if you would, sir, the question in my mind as to whether there's any kind of diplomatic relations between Black Africa and South Africa, and if there are not any kind of relations diplomatically, then exactly what is the relationship between Black Africa and White South Africa?
Well, there are diplomatic relations between certain parts of Black Africa and South Africa. These relations stem mainly from the former British protectorates, Botswana, Bechuanaland, Swaziland, and Basutoland. The reasons are fairly obvious. These places are very poor. The British government did very little to develop them, to make them stand on their own economically. And the South African government has virtually got them in a stranglehold. They have diplomatic relations with South Africa. But as the rest of Africa, very little or no diplomatic relations exist between the rest of Black Africa and Southern Africa, and the reasons are fairly obvious.
Yes. What do you think the reason, sort of mood that exists between Black Africa and South Africa, then, if there are...
A total rejection of the apartheid policies of South Africa. And in this regard, the Republic of Zambia has been extremely vocal in its condemnation of apartheid, and has indeed been warned by the South African government on certain occasions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, sir. Apartheid in South Africa, a revolution waiting to happen, is our conversation tonight with Mr. Winton Nagin, an instructor at Virginia Polytechnic Institute, and this time out to Toledo, Ohio, Mrs. Ivy is hearing Night Call over WCWA. Mrs. Ivy?
Yes, hello.
Your question, ma'am.
I'd like to ask him, does he find that being here in the United States, teaching where he teaches, that we have very much the same apartheid system here, with the exception it's more adroitly done. Say, for instance, the questions that are asked Negroes in applying for welfare in various places of jobs and employment, and the questions have nothing to do with your qualification of job, plus the fact that I read this book, Inside Africa, An American Dilemma, and especially this American Dilemma book written by Gunnar Myrdal, which traces our discrimination so finely till it seems like it's very much identical to the apartheid in Africa, except for maybe a few leeways, which is, you know, nothing compared to what human beings ought to have.
Mr. Nagin?
Well, as I said, it's very difficult to make exact comparisons. There is discrimination in the United States, and it has its effect in, I guess, a more pervasive way on the American citizens thus deprived. The differences that I tried to outline them earlier were simply that the South African government is one which actively legislates the discrimination into its statutes.
Loudly announce it here, but it's woven in such a fine thread till if you go to start up against it, say, for instance, you then begin to realize how finely woven it is, because it's like a block wall everywhere you go, and everything you do, and everywhere you live, and
yes,
almost
ma'am.
Everything you eat.
I agree with you. I think the patterns of discrimination in the United States are, in some areas, certainly a good deal more subtle. Of course, in others, they aren't.
Mm-hmm.
In areas in the South, they approximate very markedly, I believe, to the South African pattern. However, there are differences, and as I try to point them out, it seems to be that the differences are in some ways a little more subtle, and also that whatever else may be, you still have in some ways the courts to protect you, because you do have a Bill of Rights. South Africa doesn't have a Bill of Rights, and the government has the power to imprison and detain persons at its own pleasure out of the reach of the courts. Mm-hmm. An example of this may be the former president of the Pan-African Congress, Mr. Robert Sobukwe, who served his sentence through about 4 or 5 years ago, and who was still kept in jail, has at the pleasure of the South African Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, while there is discrimination, the point is that I don't know of any American that has been kept in jail without trial for as long as Mr. Sobukwe, or many other South Africans who have suffered under the iniquitous 90-day detention laws and the 180-day detention laws and so on.
Well, yes, you might not know of them, but we have some that are doing time for somebody else in jails and various institutions.
I believe it's not obvious here, but
in listening to you, I'm struck with the closeness of the same situation without the past.
Indeed.
Well, I think perhaps there's one other way to explain it. As Mr. Nagin said earlier, you find that in South Africa, it's the minority, which happens to be the white people, against the majority, which are black. And here in America, it's the majority, which are whites, against the minority, which happens to be black.
Yes, that's just about the only difference I can see, too.
Thank you for calling, ma'am. Thank you.
Very much.
Apartheid in South Africa, a revolution waiting to happen, is our conversation tonight with Mr. Winton Nagin. And this time out to New Orleans, Mr. Thompson is hearing Night Call over WDSU. Mr. Thompson?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
I've heard a number of South Africans in attempting to legitimize the apartheid policy pose the argument that the Bantu tribes of Africa or South Africa are not in fact indigenous to the nation,
and are actually migrant tribes which have come in since the foundation of the South African Republic. Is there any truth to this? And if there is, what percentage of the tribes would be considered indigenous or would be considered migrant?
Well, I don't know what the South Africans mean by indigenous. Who is indigenous anywhere on Earth, I suppose, is a kind of question one can put. Even the Red Indians in America were allegedly came from Asia, you know. That kind of argument is very specious. In a more sophisticated way, that argument has been put in this way, that Africans were allegedly migrating south along the east coast as far as a place called Plettenberg Bay and somewhere around there, which is sort of the middle of southern Africa, the bottom tip. And apparently white Africans had landed on Table Bay and were moving eastwards, and they apparently met at that point. What is meant by indigenous, of course, is very relative. The only people who are really, I guess, indigenous in South Africa in a true anthropological sense, and even this can be disputed, were the Aboriginal Hottentots, and whose offspring became Cape Coloureds and so on, and the Bushmen. Small, yellowish people, anthropologists have claimed to have lived there for a very long time. And even these Bushmen were regarded by the whites in the early days as vermin and to a large extent have been killed out.
I see. Is this argument, in fact, a prevalent one in the effort to legitimize the policy?
It's not an accepted one. I've heard it being used by various people, but no one has ever strenuously argued the point, and it really is a very specious argument.
Oh, I agree. But thank you. You've satisfied my curiosity, honestly.
Thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. This is NightCall in New York, Apartheid in South Africa, a revolution waiting to happen. Our conversation with our guest, Mr. Winton Nagin, and this time out to Indianapolis, Indiana. Mr. Banks is hearing NightCall over WTLC-FM. Mr. Banks?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, sir.
Fine, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you. Your question?
Yes, sir. Mr. Nagel, I have two questions, and I'll ask them in order here.
Fine.
Around the world, paralleling the black revolutions or the revolutions of white youth, and we've seen this in America in the civil rights struggle, white college students and whatnot have taken sides with black revolutionaries, and... We also seeing this in the Black Panthers movement out in California, that have been signed. And I was wondering if in South Africa there is any indication of the white youth with any revolutionary leanings or showing any type of sympathy for the liberation of the black people there.
Well, I would hazard a guess and say that there are some white youths who probably have revolutionary leanings, but they would appear to me to be a lot more who have distinctly liberal, pluralistic leanings, more akin to, I think, the average activist or committed white youth that you find in the United States who doesn't take a too left-wing position. Most of these youth have been concentrated in the National Union of South African Students. It organizes itself on the basis of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It is, at the present time, to my knowledge, one of the few remaining multiracial organizations in South Africa totally and dedicatedly opposed to the policy of apartheid. It still functions legally. Some of its officials have been banned. About 2 years ago, the association invited Senator Robert Kennedy to South Africa. And for inviting Senator Robert Kennedy to South Africa, the president of that association, a young man by the name of Ian Robertson, was banned. And, of course, banning means deprivation of all social mobility. He was confined to his quarters. He was not allowed to attend social gatherings. He was not allowed to attend university. In fact, he was created an unperson. On the whole, I'd say, yes, there are a number of student activists in South Africa who are actively opposing the policy of apartheid, of all races,
but the strength
including
is not significant.
The whites.
I beg your pardon, sir?
Their strength is not significant yet to make any difference.
Yeah, they're not strong enough to make any difference, but they do act in sizable numbers. And this is one of the factors which is made for the South African government continuously acting in the field of higher education, infringing to a greater extent on the whatever liberties are left in the so-called open universities in South Africa.
And are they growing?
It's difficult to say whether they're growing. They seem to have remained somewhat constant. Perhaps a number of them have, are working through various kinds of organizations now, and so it's very difficult to ascertain precisely the number. But certainly the number who oppose apartheid is no greater than those Afrikaans students who frequent the more government-orientated universities at Stellenbosch, Pretoria, Bloemfontein and other places, where they are totally in favor of the government's policy of apartheid and racial discrimination.
Thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. We'll return to our guest following station identification.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest, black South African Wynton Nagin, after station identification. Tomorrow night on Night Call, The Wasp, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant in trouble, with the controversial author Julius Horwitz of the controversial novel Wasp. He sees very little hope for our society until the white man can get over his race hang-up and allow the black man to get over his blackness. His book is about a wasp, a liberal wasp, who tries but can't bridge the gap, and why. If such a thing as a white expert on the black man and his problems exists, it's probably Julius Horwitz, the first professional welfare worker to strongly question, with chapter and verse, our whole welfare system. He calls it the Northern institution that has replaced the Southern plantation owner, the Department of Public Disposal. The Wasp in Trouble, with novelist, social welfare expert Julius Horwitz, tomorrow night on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest black South African Wynton Nagin about apartheid and a revolution waiting to happen. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And our conversation tonight, apartheid in South Africa, revolution waiting to happen, with our guest, Mr. Wynton Nagin, an American government and political science instructor at Virginia Polytechnic Institute. Mr. Nagin, you touched lightly upon the fact just prior to station identification that there were some students who were raising their voices in protest against the apartheid policy in South Africa. And earlier in our program, we did mention that there were some South African churchmen who had criticized the Prime Minister for defending the right of clergymen to criticize the government's policy of apartheid. Are there any other institutions in South Africa who are protesting the government's stand?
Well, implicitly, any organization that has anything to say normally about race relations, and I mean normally in a rather technical sense, would be an institution which, by definition, criticizes the South African government. One of these institutions has been the South African Institute of Race Relations. There are smaller groups that have been active, and to what extent is very difficult to gauge at this stage in time.
How open has their protest been?
Well, they have not been protesting, but the work they've published on apartheid and on the effects of apartheid are an implicit denunciation of the system to the extent that the government has looked great measure of disdain on the South African Institute of Race Relations. But its primary function is merely to circulate and publicize the facts of what make apartheid in South Africa. One couldn't really categorize them as a political organization at the present time, I don't believe.
Is there any effective minority political party that is protesting the government's stand?
No. South Africa, for all intents and purposes, is a white oligarchy. There are the voices of criticism and so on, limited and usually having no impact on government policies at all. One of the leading newspapers that has criticized the South African government, the Rand Daily Mail, published some data on prison torture and the modern conditions in South African prisons. Well, the editor at the present time, I understand, is on trial in terms of a rather iniquitous enactment passed by which he has to prove that which he said was true, shifting the onus of proof and so on. So to this extent, meaningful criticism is completely stifled in South Africa. The only real function that the existing groups have in South Africa, I think, at the present time are making known to the outside world what in effect is happening in South Africa. And in this, I think they have been very, very successful.
We'll take our next call from Omaha, Nebraska. Mr. White is hearing Night Call over KBON. Mr. White?
Yes.
Good evening, sir. How are you?
Fine, and you?
Fine, thank you, sir. Your question?
I enjoy your program very much, and I've been watching and listening to it every night.
Thank you very much, sir.
And your guest, I want to ask him two questions. What is being done to unite all the ready free nations in Africa?
Could you repeat that question, sir?
What is being done to unite all the ready free nations in Africa, those that have got their freedom in the last two or three years?
Yes, I understand.
And the second question, why are there so many different tribes, and what is being done to bring them all together? I understand that as soon as they get their freedom, then they start fighting among themselves. Well, what's the cause of that? That's my two questions.
All right. Okay. Give him a little time, sir. This is not a question that can be answered quickly nor simply.
Fine. Well, I'll attempt to answer that question. First of all, in Africa, there is the Organization of African Unity, the OAU. And this organization has worked and is working to unite Africans, to get them orientated to their basic needs, to attempt to speak with one voice to the developed world in terms of trade agreements, in terms of development aid and other such things needed to create a greater and viable Africa. Attempts have been made also at regional cooperation, particularly in East Africa. These of necessity have had to be slow and have to keep pace with development as such. The problems that I think at the present time inhibit complete unity, and I don't know whether you'd ever really achieve complete unity, are factors that revolve around, first of all, the great distances that prevail on the continent and which make communications exceedingly difficult. Also, the lack of great urban centers, the distribution of populations over wide areas makes difficult commercial things like marketing and concentration of labor and so on and so on. These are all factors of development that have, in a sense, impeded African speaking with a united voice. As to your second question, why are there so many different tribes? Well, one might well ask the same question of Europe. Europe certainly is divided into many, many different linguistic sects and so on. However, when you come to a more specific question, that is to say, political organization around tribal structures, then I think we have a different problem. And the problem, again, I think, relates to underdevelopment. I'm explaining this in a rather simplified way, and I do believe the argument is a much more sophisticated one, but it goes something like this. Firstly, the only way you can really break down tribalism, because tribalism is a form of social security. It relates to the extended family system and so on, and provides that measure of economic and social security for individuals. You would have to replace that form of social security with a different form of security, and that form of security would be wage labor. And to break the tribal system, therefore, you would have to provide sufficient industrial development to employ people, to make them reliant upon their own wage-earning abilities rather than on the tribal security presented by tribal structure. That is one of the problems in this particular aspect of development and tribes.
Mr. Negan, aren't the cultural ties equally important?
Cultural ties in respect of tribes, yes, but these in here, I would say, in the basic tribal structure. And they would develop according to your own pace of development in your technological fields and so on. Naturally, of course, there are differences of culture, and these differ from region to region, and language, and whatever other extraneous influences and internal influences there are on the tribe. But as I said, I think that these begin to diminish, and a good example of this diminution of tribal allegiances is in South Africa. In the industrial areas of South Africa, the workers find a greater allegiance in their being workers, in their working in wage labor and so on, and in their oppression by the apartheid system, than they do in tribal affinities. And it really is only in the very rural and backward areas of South Africa that you find tribal affinities still prevail to a very great extent.
What kind of population are you speaking of in terms of the blacks?
In Africa, there are various ethnic tribes in South Africa.
No, but what about the population?
Which population?
Of the black South Africans.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about black South Africans.
Right. We have about 30 seconds, sir.
Okay, fine. The other problem is, of course, that the black South Africans are motivated more by, as I suggested, their affinities to the various values that have been either imposed on them or they've had to accept by working in a technologically oriented society.
Mr. Negan, I'm sorry, but time has run out on us. And, sir, thank you so much for calling. This is Night Call in New York tonight. Apartheid in South Africa. Our guest, Mr. Winter Negan. This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, The Wasp, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant in trouble, with novelist, social welfare critic Julius Horowitz. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.